Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Facebook has a secret rating system to determine how trustworthy you are. Also, Amazon is so obviously working on a healthcare play. How to wean kids off of technology as they transition back to school. And Samsung is making everything smart, even your closet. All that more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 46, recorded Thursday, August 23rd, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/TNW.
And by Slide Belts, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT for 20% off. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk about the tech news that happened this week, and we are the unindicted co-conspirators of the tech news this week.
That's true. I don't know. I'm a co-nothing conspirator.
Good. Yeah. All right. Shall we get to our first interview? If you've ever found yourself mindlessly browsing through Facebook, silently judging people, you should know that Facebook is also silently judging you. Joining us to talk about Facebook's opaque trustworthiness rating scale of its users is Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what you know about this rating system.
What I know is that Facebook is, like so many tech companies, faced with all these problems, Russian meddling, fake news, people of actors, malicious actors abusing their system, ideological people, you name it, someone's trying to game Facebook. And they have to figure out in this new way who's a risk to their service and who's trustworthy. And so this scoop actually kind of came out in an interview, like one of those things that someone kind of just blurts out and it sounds very interesting, which is from Tessa Lyons, who's the product manager for misinformation there. And she's running like this whole operation of how do we determine what's a trustworthy news source? And part of that is the publisher, but part of that also is the user. And so it's this whole new way of looking at user behavior. And what they do is if you go on Facebook and you're somebody who starts flagging, Facebook lets you flag posts for like pornography, violence. They also let you flag a post if you think it's fake news. It turns out that a lot of people are doing that, flagging posts as fake news, simply because they disagree with things. And therefore, Facebook is getting all this like noise. The ratio of noise to signal is hard to suss out. So in order to do that, it's like they have to build an algorithm on top of an algorithm. And essentially what they're doing is they're looking and saying whether you or I, whether something that we flag as false actually lines up with what fact checkers found. And if I'm a person who like seems to be pretty credible and everything I mark as false is lined up with what fact checkers say, then I might get a good score. And it's between 0 and 1. But if you're somebody who just keeps flagging stuff that they disagree with, then Facebook might give you a lower score. So that's one example of a score that they have. And they've been pretty like opaque and kind of have shut down since I did the story about what the other scores are. But that's one that I was able to learn and I wrote about it.
So how, what makes them think that this, as you describe it, an algorithm on top of an algorithm, that this algorithm is going to be less likely to be gamed than any of the other algorithms, sort of algorithms all the way down?
I mean, it's such a great question because that's kind of one of the facets that makes this story so interesting or drew me to it was that it's almost like the initial algorithm is opaque and you're trying to codify human behavior into software. And you're talking about at a scale of a third of the world's population, which is on Facebook and its family of services. And it's like, yeah, how do you know? Like, I mean, I say in a way, kudos to them for figuring out this metric, like the idea that, yeah, a lot of people are gaming our system and gaming our reporting system. So we have to kind of figure out a way to measure that. But I think they also recognize that it's very inaccurate. And it's not meant to be like a unified credit score, like a scarlet letter. But the way I see it is that there's like thousands of mini scarlet letters being put upon Facebook users at all times. And that's part of the new era of risk assessment that the companies are really going into because of all the public exposure they've had around all this bad stuff.
Public exposure around the bad stuff and then public exposure about how they're managing it, how they're handling it. It almost feels like, you know, based on this particular aspect, and there are so many, as we know, around what Facebook is doing, you know, to clean up its network, is that Facebook is ultimately kind of in a lose-lose situation in the sense that they want to clean things up, so they have to devise, you know, these algorithms and these metrics in order to do so. But then once you do so, then there will always be those people on the other side saying, hey, who are you to determine that I, you know, have the right to have my voice be heard at a greater, you know, distance than somebody else? You know, Facebook is being challenged to clean up its network, so it has to do things like this. But there will be criticism because Facebook did something like this as well.
Exactly. And that was like the tension I was trying to ride in the story, which is that in order, the world is asking Facebook to clean up their platform, and that's pushing them further and further into the territory of editorial judgment. Mm-hmm. And we think about that a lot, about content. How do they judge content? We know a couple months ago they announced that they were going to be rating trusted news sources, like they were actually going to be surveying people, which they've done to say, who do you think is a trusted news source? And a lot of news organizations were upset about it. Places like the Washington Post, where I work, I think are going to benefit from that. But what they talk less about is also about how they have to understand the trustworthiness of people. You know, publishers is one thing, it's companies, but then it's people. How do you understand the people on your service and their behavior and whether that behavior is risky or credible and whether those algorithms then make a determination about whether my voice should be heard and trusted and spread to other members of the social network?
So this wasn't something that they announced that they were doing at all. It was something that maybe went like veered a little bit off the talking points in an interview, and then you dug into it. So we don't really, aside from your piece, we don't really know anything more about what they're doing in this sense.
No. I mean, I know that they're looking to this concept of user reputation. They keep talking about it like we are trying to understand user reputation. And that kind of perked my ears up. I was like, user reputation? Like, what does that mean? Like, you know, like they'll just take these kind of very, very sensitive issues. Like there's so much in that, and they'll almost reduce it to a data point. Like, okay, now we have to understand user reputation and credibility. Okay, let's all go and build a system. And I wonder if there's how deep the thinking is about the tension and sensitivity, the thoughtfulness of just around doing something like that, and what are like the unintended consequences. But yeah, exactly. It just was something that kind of came off of the messaging or out of the conversation. And then I tried to learn more about it because my ears perked up and I thought, this is definitely just worth a story in itself.
Absolutely. Obviously. So I'm really curious, you know, as we learn more about this or when we learn more about this, if we do at all, and from Facebook directly, I'm curious to know what their approach would be. Like when you're talking about people, let's say people aren't necessarily static in how they approach these things, right? Like I've been on the internet for a long time. I've been on social media, you know, Twitter since 2007. I'm sure over the course of that period of time, my style or my approach to posting has shifted. At one point, it was just happy-go-lucky and silly. Another point, it was serious, whatever. I imagine that the same could be translated potentially to some people who at one point were very trustworthy and then maybe at some point had reason or, you know, were kind of veered into a different direction to where they weren't. It's also possible that they come back around again. I'm curious to know, you know, how Facebook manages that. A person isn't always the same person forever. Maybe they change, maybe they evolve, but I don't know, maybe they don't. And how is that reflected in their online persona?
Yeah, it's such an important question because you think about like a credit score, okay? We all have credit scores, but they're not opaque. I can find out my credit score from any number of services. And if my credit score is crappy, I can do mm-hmm. certain things that in kind of a mysterious way might work to move it up. And it's going to take a while, and I might not entirely know what went into my credit, but there are certain levers I can try to push. And it's not the case with a private company because you don't know how you're being rated. You don't know the criteria. You don't know if it can change over time or you can ameliorate it. And, you know, Facebook would push back on the story and sort of say, look, we're not giving a big scarlet letter to everyone on Facebook. We're not, they kept telling me we don't have a unified credibility score. And I said, I get that. And I put that in the story. But I still think it's like we're talking about thousands of micro decisions that in certain ways add up to the scarlet letter. And that's what's very interesting.
I mean, in a way, we shouldn't really be surprised by this at all. I mean, everyone always talks about how it feels like Facebook is actually listening to our conversations because we'll talk about something and then CNN.
Well, they say they're not.
Yeah, they say they're not. And I believe that they're not. And I mean, the truth really lies in the fact that we're much less original than we think we are and that we're all really buying the same thing. We're made up of signals. And, you know, our decision making is always going to, you know, taken in aggregate is going to filter down into the, you know, the that small thing. And we only pay attention, right, when it actually matches up to what mm-hmm. we were talking about. You know, yep. we'd all the rest of the ads that don't match up, that aren't appropriate, we probably don't see them. But I mean, did this surprise you, or are you at the point, having done this research and worked in this field for as long as you had, just like, well, they have so many signals. Of course, they know whether we're trustworthy or not.
You know, it was so funny. That's such an interesting question because, you know, as a reporter, it's really difficult sometimes because you don't want to get jaded and cynical to the point where you don't understand what would be interesting to other people. And I try really hard not to do that. It's true. You know, I've been, you know, before this job at the Washington Post, I covered big data and AI at the Wall Street Journal. So I'm very interested in signals and data points and algorithms. And thinking about what goes into them. And I feel like now it's become just a bigger conversation. There was this part of me, which, you know, I did write it in the story, to make the point that companies like Facebook and tech companies have been rating people for a long time. I mean, your Uber rating. Mm-hmm. I mean, the world of ratings, your Amazon score, I mean, everything is rated. But that's more of a transparent rating, though obviously there's been, you know, issues people have had where it's not transparent. Like, I think your Uber rating is transparent, but your Lyft isn't, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, and so it's a good question of, did it surprise me? I think on one level it didn't, because the tech industry takes for granted that people should be measured and rated in a way they never have before in human history, the level at which you can study people's behavior because of how much we use online services. On the other hand, because of that, I think there has to be more thoughtfulness about what goes into these choices. And it can't just be like a casual, this is how we measure user reputation. It has to be a conversation of, what are the implications of us measuring user reputation? What should we tell people about how we understand their, quote, reputations that we're divining, you know? And that's what I didn't see happening. So that's what, I don't know if surprise, but that's where I'm hoping that the conversation goes, and where the you know, reporting like ours can push the conversation in that direction. That's what I hope.
And we have examples. We have examples of this right now as far as where that could possibly go, right? I think it's in China, a lot of the technology, you know, there's a reputation score that is now painting to a large degree what people have access to, whether they can do this versus can't do that. And it's all driven by this kind of score that's given based on different interactions through different services and in their daily life and everything like that. It really feels, and of course, no episode of Tech News Weekly would be complete if I didn't mention that Black Mirror totally has an episode on this very topic. But yeah, I mean, we have examples, right? We have examples.
Black Mirror.
Yes, exactly. So many things feel like Black Mirror these days. I don't know what's real and what's fake, but I mean, we have these examples to point to. So, you know, when you hear this sort of thing happening around Facebook, on one hand, it feels compartmentalized to be, oh, well, that's just a Facebook thing. But on the other hand, you could see how that blows up to something much bigger if people are complacent, or rather, kind of care less about understanding what's happening.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do, like kind of reawaken it so that it doesn't feel so normal, right? That it really, because it's like it's becoming Black Mirror. So.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. Elizabeth Dwoskin is the Silicon Valley reporter at the Washington Post and has several stories this week about Russian and Iranian influence in social media. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
It was great talking with you.
Bye.
All right, up next, we're going to discuss the near certainty of Amazon's move into the healthcare industry. But before we do that, we need to thank the sponsor of this episode. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets, and then, of course, customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. So developers, listen up. The easy-to-use control panel and API actually lets you, developers out there, spend more time coding and less time managing the infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance, access to the compute resources that you need at the lowest rates. It's going to save up to 55% compared to the other cloud providers out there. And you'll always know what you'll pay per month with a flat pricing structure. That's across all data center regions. Included at no cost, you get a number of things. 99.99% uptime, SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full domain name system management, DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, a super easy to use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry leading price performance. So you can sign up today and check it out for yourself and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/TNW. That's do.co/TNW, and you'll get a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Earlier this week, a prominent Harvard physician announced on Twitter that he would be joining Amazon. Just another hint in the list of many that Amazon is inching ever closer to some kind of healthcare play. Joining us to talk about what this might look like is Paris Martineau of The Outline. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as you point out in the piece, healthcare is bloated and inefficient. What could Amazon do to improve it besides, of course, having my Echo Dot just immediately dispense any medication it felt like I needed based on how I spoke to it?
I mean, beside that very useful tool, there are a lot of different things Amazon could probably do in the healthcare industry. They recently purchased a startup called PillPack, which is known for being able to deliver medication straight to people's doors. You don't have to go to a pharmacy. That was essentially, I think they bought it for $1 billion cash because it had such a high value and has really been shaking up the pharma industry. In addition to that, the medical industry is really far behind most of the tech world. I mean, most hospitals are still using fax machines. There's no electronic system really that's going to connect all of the medical records from center to center or from doctor to doctor and so forth. And so Amazon has been looking into this telemedicine and a variety of other health tech options for a while now.
And so they've actually been hiring doctors. I mean, what would they just as consultants?
So Amazon hasn't said anything publicly about what they are hiring these people to do. But the doctor that was hired most recently, whose name I might mispronounce a little bit, Maulik Majmudar. He is a cardiologist. He's been a professor at Harvard and MIT. I would assume that he has been a consultant for other health tech companies before. So I'm assuming that he's providing similar services, though neither he nor Amazon has stated anything on the record to that degree. They've also hired Mark Levine, who used to, I believe, be the CEO or a leading officer of a large healthcare company that kind of specializes in Medicare and all of the different complexities of kind of setting up a system like that. They've hired the former FDA chief health information officer, Taha Kass-Hout, and a bunch of other health tech experts and officers and academics over the past couple of years. They seem to be assembling the sort of dream team of health technology, albeit in secret.
Amazon and actually other, you know, a lot of the other really big tech companies are seen as kind of harbingers of doom when they suddenly put their focus on a particular industry that they're not yet in. And then everybody within that industry starts freaking out and going, oh, no, they're going to take my jobs. Would that be the case here, would you say, if Amazon actually decides, as it seems like it's doing, to jump into the healthcare industry? Like, what is that? What does that potentially look like? Is this more of a commerce play, or, you know, or something else? And does that spell, you know, a pretty big, a significant amount of doom for anyone else that's in that space?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously don't know what is going through Jeff Bezos' head, but it seems that I would assume that they're trying to automate the process, streamline the process, be able to get the sort of contracts to make this whole process more efficient. They have been specifically beating out a number of other cloud hosting services, they being Amazon's web service platform, for contracts and hospitals and things like that for a while now. So I assume that their overall move would be something more like that, to where they want to build systems that are going to kind of revolutionize this market, and basically every other tech company out there, I'm sure, wants to be the first one to do it, because pharmaceuticals, much less the healthcare industry in general, is a huge, I guess, untapped market if you're thinking about it from this perspective. And there's a lot of, I guess, potential to make money. And when it comes to stealing jobs, I'm sure that their end game is to automate everything.
Yeah, right.
And that would result in the loss of actual human jobs, as you've seen from every Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
But since they haven't created any physical companies yet that we know of, I'm not exactly sure what the robot healthcare revolution is going to look like yet.
But, I mean, sometimes they probably would say this also, that sometimes automating healthcare might mean that they're getting it to a place that didn't have it, or maybe didn't have the certain mm-hmm. expertise with, like, telemedicine might be something that they're doing as well. You write an article.
Yeah, they have been, they have this kind of secretive group called 1492 that not many people know much about. A CNBC investigation last year kind of uncovered it more generally. But they and the people in that group and in some other companies that Amazon is running are working on telemedicine, which has had a huge impact in healthcare around the world when it comes to connecting people in rural areas, or perhaps people who don't have access to certain types of services, with doctors. So obviously there are countless benefits to this, but it's always nice to be a little wary of, I don't know, if one or two giant tech companies are going to take over an entire industry, what else might fly under our radars? But
absolutely. And I mean, Amazon, you know, there are all these signals that is moving into this direction. We've seen Google, we've seen Apple, you know, have their own, you know, types of signals, not to mention they have devices that, you mm-hmm. know, kind of interplay with our health, like wearables and that sort of stuff. When you compare these different companies, I mean, in my head, Amazon seems like the one that's kind of ripe to be the one that truly disrupts compared to the others. But I don't know, what's your opinion? How does Amazon stack up in coming into the healthcare industry based on what we know about Amazon and its many strengths compared to some of these other technology companies like Google and Apple?
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of thought of Amazon as the sleeping giant. I mean, we all know Amazon, we talk about it, but when we're thinking about Amazon, we're almost exclusively thinking about, you know, the company that we buy cheap stuff from and get shipped to our door in a couple of days, or maybe Amazon Web Services, if that's your niche. But Amazon has its hand in so many pies. I mean, when it's coming to like web services, or they have been doing a lot of contract with the military, Amazon really has the infrastructure and the insane and ever expanding size to really be able to make a push into this market. And they have a history of art of being interested in it and inching into it over the last couple of years. albeit I guess Google, I would say, would be the second contender. They most recently increased an investment in Oscar Health. I believe there was an article in Wired about that perhaps last week. But all of these different tech companies are looking to get a slice of the healthcare technology pie. But I feel like Amazon has been the one that consistently and over the longest period of time has been making gains in both a personnel and staff sense, and that they are assembling the members of the team that would concretely be able to do this, and actually forming companies and buying up other companies and spending serious capital on moving into this market. I mean, $1 billion for a pill delivery startup, I guess, isn't that much money to Jeff Bezos, but in comparison to the sort of money that other companies are spending to get into this niche market, it's pretty sizable.
I also think it's sort of sending signals of the importance of this aging population that we have, you know, just baby boomers or beyond, or even less than that. I mean, just the fact that there's so many people that not only that there's, you know, more people getting older, but we're living longer. And so we're going to depend on, probably have to depend on medicine in a greater fashion.
Yeah. And also, there are a lot of interesting crossovers with this and the gig economy, and I guess the future of the Affordable Health Care Act. A company Amazon kind of recently formed, I think back in January, with JP Morgan Chase and Berkshire Health, ostensibly this company, which they haven't released any information about it, like its name or what it's been doing since then. But it was essentially to create a more affordable healthcare program for their employees and to be able to streamline many parts of the medical and electronic process for their workforce, which is obviously huge. But the way I've been seeing it is that this would be the perfect testing ground for if you'd want to, I don't know, create a healthcare company that'd be able to wrangle in all of the gig economy workers who don't have affordable healthcare options, or anybody who wasn't able to afford the healthcare options in their state once the ACA has crumbled and there's nothing left. Or I guess, yeah, like you said, any of the our aging population who is going to have increasingly costly healthcare needs.
Pharmaceutical Turk comes to mind. I could totally see Amazon branding this. And then I think it was back in February, BasicCare was quietly announced, which is Amazon's kind of over-the-counter line of products, like medication products and stuff. So it's not like they're not playing in this space. They're just keeping it really low key. Although I do like the sound of Pharmaceutical Turk. I think they should go that route.
I think that's good. Yeah, you should buy that domain now. So in a couple of years, you'll be able to sell it at a premium price.
Yeah, interesting. I could totally see, though, like in sort of seriousness, I could see like a very profitable, very lucrative business on Amazon's part on just one aspect of this, from the subscribe and save sort of angle when it comes to medication, because a lot of people, you know, it's a challenge to keep up on that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that seems like one area where Amazon could really kind of come in and make it easier for people.
Yeah, buy your painkillers in bulk.
Yeah, totally.
You can get like one of those Amazon Dash buttons before your painkillers.
More morphine, please.
Yeah. It'll be sent right to you. Yeah, I mean, it just makes a lot of sense. This has been a trend that's been happening a lot in Silicon Valley with startups as of late, where whenever, I guess, a drug, I think Viagra over the last couple of months went generic, and then you saw a huge pop-up of startups and smaller companies that basically exist to they're able to manufacture Viagra for cheap now that it's generic. They don't have to pay anybody to deliver it to people. And so long as you use, so long as you have a easy delivery system, which if you're Amazon, you have the most well-developed delivery system in the world, you would be able to make a killing.
Hmm. Paris, thank you so much for joining us again. Paris Martineau is a staff writer at The Outline. She covers tech, privacy, and social media manipulation, and she is Paris Martineau on Twitter. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Paris.
It is back to school time, which means some of us are still very busy tearing the iPads out of our children's cold not dead hands. Georgia Dow from iMore is here to help. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts. High quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. Belts are back, especially for the ladies. My new favorite belt is the ratchet belt from Slide Belts. I know your belt isn't something you think about too often, but here at TWIT, we think about it pretty often since we've all gotten on the Slide Belts train. Jason has one of the Slide Belts right there.
Just looks like a normal belt, no big deal, except ratchets. Mm-hmm. You can see them in there. Yeah,
I believe cool. That is the vegan leather.
Yes, it is. Oh, it is.
The vegan leather mm-hmm. belts, which is very nice. They don't have holes in them like your old belts. They have the ratchet. It's a patented ratchet design. It adjusts precisely to you.
Yes.
32 adjustment options.
It's hard doing this backwards, but it is. I promise you it's really easy.
It's very easy once you're, you know, you're not doing
it. I love the sound of that.
It's nice. More comfortable than any other belt that I've worn. It's an improvement over the traditional belt because you can easily remove the buckle and then mix and match with other straps. They have all kinds. They have a little rose gold. They have skinny belts. They have all kinds of belts. Take a look at their website and just check it out. Great gifts, too. Full grain and top grain leathers, high quality canvas, and animal-friendly vegan slide belts. They can be worn casually around the house. You can wear them around the office, as we all do, as I've said before. The ratchet sound just echoes through the TWIT bathrooms. It's also great for date night. That sound. Yep, that is the sound. They're easy to take off and put on while you go through security. And maybe you're not convinced. Maybe that sound that Jason keeps making is not convinced.
Oh, sorry.
It's fun. I mean, if you like to mess with things, you know, to keep it's like a fidget spinner right there on your belt.
Kind of is. Yeah.
If you're not convinced, Slide Belts offers a 1-year warranty, free exchanges, and no hassle returns. I know you're ready for a better belt. Go to slidebelts.com/twit. Use the code TWIT at checkout to receive 20% off your order. At slidebelts.com/TWIT. Don't forget to use that code TWIT for 20% off. And we thank Slide Belts for their support.
It's back to school time, if you didn't know. And parents of the modern age know exactly what that means. Technology withdrawals. Pew Research Center published the results of a new nationwide survey that focused on screen time and device distractions, among other things. And while we may think that Generation Z is obsessive about their screens, the report seems to indicate that those kids would agree, one, and maybe they aren't very thrilled about it either. Joining us to talk about this is Georgia Dow, senior editor at iMore and psychotherapist. Welcome back, Georgia. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to get you here. So first, as parents, I would say it's easy to look at our children and think they're too obsessed with screen technology. I know, at least in my case, my parents said the same thing about me when I was a kid and I was playing all the time on my Commodore 64.
And look where you are now.
Exactly. Thank you. That's what I'm trying to tell them to this day. No. Are things different now? Are we looking at a different moment in time and the different obsession around technology than, let's say, 25 years ago?
No, it's probably about the same. I think that the hardest thing with getting back to school is that it's very different. Like children usually have a lot of time to be able to do whatever they want with. Usually they can just play video games or watch TV or, you know, be on YouTube till their brains melt. And then you have to kind of shift back to school where you are sitting for 8 hours a day with a teacher chatting away at you. And that's a huge difference. So it can be really difficult for children to adjust, which I think was the same beforehand. If you're playing outside all the time and you have to sit down in a chair and stay there, that's also really difficult. So even if your children are active, this can be a very anxiety-inducing time for them.
Absolutely. So the Pew study shows obviously how concerned parents are. It touches on a number of topics, but it focuses on that at one point, and not just about their children's screen time, but also their own. Maybe talk a little bit about how parents are. I mean, in many cases, obviously, parents are their children's role models, and it's no different with technology, right?
It's true. And I can see when I'm bored or I'm sitting or I'm waiting in line, used to be that I would like look at a magazine or I would talk to someone. And now I grab my phone and I play some right. sort of inane video game or search the web for some sort of news story. And so I think that all of us use technology to kind of deal with boredom. And that's one of the things that you want your children to kind of get ready with, because even if you have the best school for your child, they will spend a good amount of their time being bored. And so probably one of the first tips you'd want to help them to get ready for school is to limit their time playing technology, watching TV, being on the web, so that they can practice being bored. It's a skill. I know it doesn't sound good, but it's actually a skill. The more you can be bored and delay gratification, better things come to you.
Absolutely.
So I want to get back to what you said about brains melting while watching YouTube, because that is where I am.
You've seen the melted brains?
I have. So I mean, yes, myself included. But my 13-year-olds don't play Fortnite, and so I know I should be grateful for that alone. But I kind of wish they did, because the alternative is, you know, hours of YouTube. And so, you know, school started, they're back in school, they work really hard, and they do all their homework, and then it's just they're exhausted just by the... just the, you know, just being an eighth grader, being a 13-year-old boy and being, you know, having to do school and the social and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like all they want to do is just veg out and watch. And it's like science-y videos. You know, I look at their history. It's nothing bad, but it's just the fact that it feels like a little bit like a drug.
It is a drug. And even if you're watching something that is great, your brain is being passively induced with information to that. And so if you can limit the amount of time that your children spend on technology, so we have a reward-based system that the kids do work or, you know, do chores or other things and they're around the house, then they can earn time that they could play video games or watch TV or deal with that. So something that helps them kind of moderate that time is great, because the thing is that you are exhausted, and a little bit of time to be able to shut down is great for everyone's brain. But also, being bored is when you're creative. It's when you think of different things. You think outside of the box. You plan for something. You'll play something else that may not be as passively interesting. And so you want to give everyone, adults included, that space to be able to do that. If I'm watching something that's interesting, I'm not going to be clearing out my office and cleaning it, which is a complete mess if you can take a look behind me, that I really need to get done. But if I didn't have tech, I'll be cleaning my office, because that's the next best thing.
Yeah, I think that the challenge that I have, and I don't think it was in this report necessarily, but it was something I heard earlier this summer about how Generation Z, to you know, overgeneralize, let's say, but how they experience like a phone boredom, how even though the internet is this access to unlimited avenues of the world, you still find yourself staring at a screen being bored at everything that you possibly do. Yet that isn't enough for us to put it down, or, you know, for someone to put it down. Instead, you just continue like dwelling in this boredom state while staring mm-hmm. at your screen. I know yeah. I've done that, and I've tried really hard in the past, you know, couple of years to kind of fight the urge to just endlessly scroll when I'm bored, because I don't get any true personal satisfaction out of it. But it takes a lot of effort. I have to imagine that's more difficult for children than it is for adults. And I know as an adult, it's really difficult.
Yeah, it is. And what we're doing is you're also, whatever you're doing at any moment, you're training your brain to be better at it. So while you're staring and having all of this passive feedback of something being fed to you, and phones and apps and websites are made to be addictive. That's what they spend their money on, is to keep you there. They want to keep you there. If it's Facebook, they want your information. If you're not there, they're not getting your information for that. So they spend a lot of time to try to make this as passively enjoyable as possible to be there. And what you're doing is, the longer that you spend on that, you're actually teaching your brain to be more and more addicted to that. It's the same thing as any other addiction. So the ways to be able to curb your time to that is actually put physical limits on that. So, you know, I'm not going to use tech until 9 p.m. at night, or for
for the next hour, I'm not going to use anything. And just feel how difficult it is to be able to put your phone down. To be honest, if my phone is that close to me and I have a few moments that I'm bored, I almost pick it up without even like it's, I'm not even subconsciously, I'm picking up my phone and taking a look at it. I haven't even thought about it. And that's a scary thing. And I'm sure that I'm not the only one that suddenly realizes that their phone is on their hand while they're watching a TV show or even doing something else that usually I'd be able to watch all the way through.
So putting your phone away, putting it away from you, that's one tip. What are some other tips for really teaching kids self-regulation? Because looking at, you know, if you have teenagers, I mean, 4 or 5 more years, and then they're going to be out of the house, ideally.
And, no, they're going to be out of the house.
And so it's like we have all these rules, like you have to plug your phone in our room at night, and you have to, you know, and it's like, great, well once they're... you know, once they're out of the house, they're not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be there anymore to make them do that. What are some tips in teaching them to do that themselves?
Right. So when they're really young, when your children are young, they may be too young to learn self-discipline. The same thing where you have to help them with brushing their teeth or making sure that they do their homework. And some children are very self-motivated and some children are not. The first thing that you want to do is have that conversation. I have this conversation a lot with my children because it's really important. I want them to be able to go to a restaurant and be able to have a nice meal at a nice restaurant and not be like, when are we getting home so I can go back to my addiction? Mm-hmm. And so my kids themselves, I said, well, maybe even at this time where they play like 2 hours a day, they're like, we might still be playing too much time. And that's only during the summertime. Though today they're actually melting their brains. It's my son's birthday today. So they're melting their brains today with a full day of video games. So there's a slight amount of irony as I hear them playing behind me. but they actually talk about that they want they understand how the brain works because like lucky or not lucky, I'm their mom. And so they want to be able to be better at delaying gratification. They want school to not be so torturous because again, the more that you're not used to delaying gratification, the more torturous school is. So adding some like no tech times to the whole family's day, you'll hate me for a little while, but later you'll love me for it, is wonderful. Because while you're all sitting there bored, someone's going to be like, well, let's play a board game or let's do something else or let's play cards or let's go for that bike ride, the bikes that have been rusting in the garage that we haven't really been being as active with as we should. And also, if you do that before you go to sleep, like an hour and a half or 2 hours before they go to sleep, because sleep is something else before school that you're going to want them to get ready to, is, you know, like, listen, let's have no technology for 2 hours before sleep. Let's read or play a game or chat, which also doesn't happen with technology around. Then sleep makes it easier as well because your brain waves are just a little bit more relaxed. You've ended up being able to create that melatonin that says it's time to go to bed. So that also can work out, but you may have to actually have a time that the whole family does this. So you're all going through withdrawal together. You can use each other as a support system and be able to handle that. And then as they get older, usually around the ages of like 17 or 18, depending on, again, boys and girls, because our brains are not fully developed until 24, they're better to self-moderate and deal with things themselves. Again, depending upon personality type.
Absolutely. Agree with everything you just said there. So much of that has been, you know, the challenge that, you know, I have a 5 and an 8-year-old daughter, a challenge that we've been kind of going through in the past couple of years. And I'd say within the last year, we really kind of drew the line in the sand and said, all right, so here's what we're doing. There is, you know, a specific time on the weekends where they can have the technology in the way that they want to sit down with a tablet, watch videos or whatever. But during the weeknights, like it's no technology. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard in the beginning because, you know, at least our 8-year-old now, when she was a couple of years younger, she was really used to having access to these things. And so it took a little bit of time, but it amazes me now because when they're bored, like they kind of give it up almost immediately, you know, asking for this technology and they find something to do. Like, lo and behold, they go outside and they entertain themselves the way I remember doing when I was a kid before I discovered the Commodore 64.
They're the only... Right, exactly. They're the only children that are on the block. They're playing alone because everyone else is inside and on their technology.
Yes.
It's the same thing with my kids. They are allowed to use technology for maybe doing stick bot, making movies, learning to play chess.
Sure.
But if not, they're writing books, making their own animations, or going outside or playing a game, or they're in the pool, which today I won't see them off their technology. One is because we restrict it, so it does make it a little bit more salacious.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that compared to technology, it's really hard to compete with any other activity that you'd want them to do. If you want them to really enjoy doing a sport and other things, if you do not have a highly self-motivated child, then it's a difficult thing to compete with. And so taking out that, getting them ready for the boredom that will be school is a gift that you can give to your children. And so right now would be a great time to start that by limiting the amount of tech, getting ready for their time when they're going to go to bed, dealing if they have any school anxiety, you know, bringing them to the school, running through what they have to get, getting their school supplies. Because parents also, we get anxious as well. We're often delaying that anxiety by going on technology ourselves or, you know, looking at Facebook instead of getting the other things ready that we kind of hear in the back of our head we have to get done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that, you know, speaking from a personal level, like I can sort of, you know, be so anxious of like, oh, they're watching so much YouTube. And, you know, it really might not be that much that they're really watching. But
right.
they feel that. And so it's better than just, you know, complaining about it. Do something about it. Like, make you talk to us about what we can do. So
we really appreciate it.
Yes.
Georgia Dow, iMore, and so many other awesome things online. Where do you want people to follow you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm sometimes still there. It's at George_Dow.
Right on. Georgia, we really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
So, Jason, you wanted to talk about your new Samsung phone,
but you can. Well, I mean, it's here.
I know. The note. But I wanted to talk about something more revolutionary from Samsung. It is the Air Dresser. It's an internet-connected closet. It connects with the SmartThings IoT platform. It'll help you organize your clothes, clean your clothes. It airs. It uses air. That's why it's called the Air. It's not, it doesn't float in the air. It uses air to clean your clothes. It steams. It dries. It purifies. Pre-orders started this week. You can get it delivered next month. The IoT closet, the closet of the future.
You've been asking for such a long time. Samsung finally listened to you and made the Air closet.
Although it looks like it's for men.
Because it has suits in it.
Because suits, you don't necessarily need to, like, you don't wash suits. Like, my clothes, I don't know if I could get away with just air, cleaning them with air.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we'd have a price on it. Burke really wants to know how much it is so that he can get one. And I don't think that we have a price on it. But I'm imagining it's not inexpensive.
I mean, I could look that up, but
Sam,
I didn't.
When I see an item like this, a product like this, and Samsung is definitely, you know, one of the many companies that will just kind of be bold and do something like this. I have to wonder, like, from a research and development perspective, from, you know, feeling out the market, understanding before they even launch a product, what the price point's going to be, what the sales volume's going to be. Like, what is that bar that they then go, the Air closet? Yeah, sure, it's worth our time. Mm-hmm. I would think that no one would buy this, but apparently someone will. I think Samsung probably did enough work to know that there's at least some market for this. I just don't understand.
Yeah, I think it's, well, they keep saying that it is for millennials. Thank you, Scooter X. It is, this is the LG.
LG's version. So $1,500-ish.
Is $1,553 down from $2,000.
Steep discount. 25% discount.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's for millennials who don't know how to do anything for themselves, apparently. I'm not saying that.
What are you saying?
Millennials who watch or listen to this. That's what they're claiming.
I will say that Samsung had said not too long ago, I think it was last year, that by 2020, all of the electronics that they make, and I wonder if they actually mean all. I'm sure there would be electronics that they make that wouldn't fall into this category, will be smart devices.
Mm.
So this kind of would potentially tie into that. They're like, we'll make let's make a closet. You know, we got to make it smart.
Right.
Because we said we would.
They wouldn't make a closet otherwise, yeah, right?
Like, they wouldn't just make.
They're not in the closet business.
Closet, yeah.
Smart. I mean, I have to say that I do need a little bit of tech in my closet.
Yeah.
I would like to have my closet organized. Okay. Like, I would like to know everything that's in there and have it rotate in certain fashion.
Like when you put it in, it would put that at the very back and be like, you can't wear this for another 3 weeks.
Yes.
Otherwise, you will have repeated it.
What I want. Yeah. I want an algorithm to work for me in my closet. I want to use artificial intelligence, and I haven't figured out any way, like, at all. I tried a Google Sheet. It didn't work out very well. If someone knows of a, you know, I guess we should probably do something like that on Know How. I don't want like the Amazon's version of like taking a picture of me and telling me whether my outfit is ugly or not. I don't want that. I have my clothes, and I want to know when to wear them next.
Okay. Well, I totally am the person that will wear a shirt on Tuesday for All About Android, and then the next Tuesday be like, oh, I'm going to wear this shirt. And then look at the thumbnails of the two episodes and realize both Tuesdays I wore the same shirt. Mm-hmm. Do it all the time.
Don't think we don't notice, Jason Howell.
Now you will if you didn't before. I notice, and I kind of don't care. But I mean, there's a low-tech solution, and that is on your hanger. Take the clothes from one side and always put it on the other side, and always take from that and put it over there, and put it over there, and it'll just cycle through. But then you're working with the same order every single time.
Right.
And so it's really hard. Sometimes you just really, you like that shirt today and you want to wear it today.
Right. But my issue, yes, I want it to be at a random order. And also, I read the Japanese Art of Tidying Up.
Oh,
which
okay.
Then I have my clothes organized by color and by weight.
Oof.
So the way that it has, like, the heaviest coats go here, and then it has to go. That's the way she says clothes. Con Marie method says clothes like to be organized from left to right, heavy to light, and dark to light color. So I can't do what you're talking about. And that system I like. So if I want to wear a dark shirt, I want to wear a light shirt. I'll take a picture of my closet and let you guys know. I know someone out there, I know that most of our audience is male. I understand that. But you ladies out there, you know, or men who really like clothes, I know you're out there. Come on, I got so excited.
So much work. I just want to pull a shirt off the hanger and put it on. It's so much work. Mm-hmm. But I understand.
Thank you.
I'm working to understand.
Sympathy, not empathy. I get it.
Sure. Well, you know what? We want to hear from you, because I'm sure you've got thoughts on this. TNW@twit.tv. Let us know how you feel about this. And we'd love to read it. And even better, we'd love to read it on the show. So do that. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/live.
And if you want to subscribe to our show, please do. Go to twit.tv/TNW. Find all the ways you can subscribe. And if you have an answer to my closet AI desires, please do nothing before you tweet it at me. I'm at Megan Moroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps out on the show. Thanks to Burke, Josh, Jammer B, Colleen was in here. Alex was in here. It was a party before the show. We've got a guest in here watching. Thank you for stopping by.
That's
great. Great to have some folks dropping in and making us feel important. And thanks to you for watching each and every week. We'll see you next time on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Oh,
don't forget. So my goodness, you did
overwhelmed
forget.
With my closet desires. I hope.